Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business of Sports.
The business of sports can be intimidating or hard for a startup to break into.
We really appreciate when our owners are actually there, you know, with us through the journey.
Teams, ours especially, have been very intentional to diversify at all levels of the company.
I think we're in the golden years for the NFL and college football.
Our demographic reach has continued to expand.
This is going to be really unlocking the streaming platform for sports fans.
Sports valuations are rising. We'll see when they peak.
You don't have to be the best in your sport to make a whole ton of money.
Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Barr.
I'm Scarlett Fu.
And I'm Damian Sassauer.
We've got a Hall of Famer on the show today. We'll be speaking with MLB all-time great Tom Glavine as we make our way through baseball's first month.
For the most part, I think the teams that we thought were going to be good have gotten off to a good start. I guess it's a little bit concerning that we've had a number of really good pitchers get hurt already, so that's always a concern.
Glavine is also participating in the Invited Celebrity Classic Golf Tournament after the Masters. We'll talk a little with him about that. Plus, speaking of golf, we'll check in on the Masters and on the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. Are they getting along? All that is straight ahead on the Bloomberg Business of Sports, but first, we turn to a big story over the last few weeks in Kansas City. Voters in the area rejected a bid to fund a $2 billion stadium revamp. And with us to talk about that, Bloomberg News Municipal Finance reporter Amanda Albright. Thank you so much, Amanda, for talking with us on the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to talk about this.
Well, just bottom line, why do you think that the vote failed among the people in Kansas City?
I think there's a lot of reasons, but mostly I think people didn't have a great understanding of what they were voting for. A lot of the people I talked to said the process felt very rushed, and they were worried about local impact to an area of town where the Royals wanted to move to, that is a very beloved area, you know, bustling with coffee shops and restaurants. And there was a lot of concern about what that would do to local businesses there, if I had to summarize. But I think there's a lot of different factors that probably drove people to vote in different ways for different reasons.
What does this say about, or and maybe perhaps we're reading too much into this, and so this question is loaded, but what does this say about taxpayers' willingness to subsidize professional sports teams' new homes? Because for so many years, we've heard, you know, team owners trot out academic studies that showed if we build this new stadium, this is going to be give the local economy a jump start. It's going to create jobs. It's going to bring more people downtown. This is all good for everyone. Just, you know, pass this bill so that we can get some subsidies and we can get this economic jolt started. What does this tell us?
I think we're in the, and excuse the pun, we're in the early innings of growing pushback to these proposals because there is growing understanding among the public that essentially these deals don't always deliver on the economic benefits promised. There's a ton of academic research about the economic benefits of stadiums and just essentially, I mean, some of the economists I talked to said that it's basically a universally agreed upon fact among sports economists that stadiums aren't necessarily worth the public investment. So I think there's growing public awareness of that. And so we will likely see more cases like Kansas City where voters will push back on these deals. I mean, there are cases of voters being in favor of such proposals. Of course, some of them do pass. But I think the important thing to note is that even if the public doesn't necessarily want their tax dollars going to really wealthy team owners, it's not always up to the voters. Usually teams will go to city councils, you know, county commissions, state legislatures. They have other ways of securing these subsidies that don't always involve going to the voters. And in terms of the Chiefs and the Royals, you know, my expectation is just kind of reading the tea leaves on what's been said publicly. My expectation is that they will probably pursue some sort of deal where maybe they don't have to go back to the voters. I don't know that for sure, but I think that's kind of the playbook that we've seen other teams use in the past, is that say they have kind of a defeat at the ballot box, but then they're able to find other ways to get some of the money that they're looking for. It's, you know, they haven't said this publicly, but just it seems like officials, local officials here seem very committed to keeping both teams in the city. So I think that's kind of the expectation, but there's a lot that we don't know yet.
Not just any local official, Amanda. 5-time All-Star, 8-time Golden Glove winner Frank White of Jackson County, Missouri. I mean, he was one of the guys leading the charge against these quote-unquote billionaire bullies, the Beat the Billionaires campaign. I mean, talk to me about, you know, what is the sentiment locally to people like Clark Hunt, the Chiefs CEO, or John Sherman, who owns the Royals? I mean, are they not well-liked locally in Kansas City?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that it's not necessarily that they're not well-liked. I think a lot of the rhetoric on the side of the election that was against voting yes for this tax, I think basically it wasn't necessarily that people didn't like them. It was more just that they didn't understand why a sales tax that's worth $2 billion over 40 years, so a huge amount of money. They didn't understand why those teams needed that size of a subsidy when they could probably finance the renovations themselves. I'm not sure about the Royals owner, but at least with the Hunt family, they're very wealthy. And so I think that's kind of this growing public pushback to public subsidies for stadiums. I think a huge part of it is, even though someone may love the team and be a huge supporter, they are starting to question, you know, why their tax dollars should go to help those teams finance major assets, which are their obviously their physical stadiums. It's kind of like the way I've been thinking about it is, you know, if you as a homeowner have a chance to boost the value of your home by 50% based off a subsidy from the federal government, why wouldn't you do that? But it's kind of one way to think about it. You know, it's just it makes them wealthier.
But
a lot of people are questioning why we would do that.
Well, Amanda, I just want to, you know, mention here, I mean, John Sherman's wife, you know, said, you know, I think she posted on the internet, you know, that the Royals and Chiefs should get out of here. I even think that Dallas, the mayor of Dallas, was even suggesting that the Kansas City Chiefs, that they can handle two football teams in Dallas. You know, can you imagine the Cowboys and the Chiefs both? I mean, talk to us about, you know, some of that rhetoric that's coming out off the back of this vote. I mean, is there any possibility that the Chiefs or the Royals could leave Kansas City?
I think that it's definitely possible, but a lot of people have cautioned me on this narrative, because a lot of teams will say that they're leaving, you need to vote for this subsidy, and then they don't actually leave because, yeah, you know, where could they go? And I think a lot of sports economists have cautioned and said, and basically said, that this is like a negotiation tactic for a team to say that if you don't support this tax increase, you know, we're going to up and leave. One of the most notable examples is the St. Louis Rams, which had pursued a subsidy for a new stadium there, but they were actually rejected. And so the team actually moved to Los Angeles, but that stadium had to be privately financed, actually. I don't know if they ever pursued public financing or what those kind of conversations looked like behind the scenes, but the owner ended up privately financing the, you know, beautiful stadium that's now in that city.
How in the world? I guess the teams were, especially the Chiefs, were saying, Amanda, look, hey, we've given you back-to-back Super Bowls. There's no way in the world you can say no. Well, they were wrong, Amanda.
Yes. One of the interesting things about this vote is that the Chiefs are so successful, and then the Royals they've been struggling a little bit lately. So the fact that the vote was tied together, you know, it couldn't really be seen as like a vote on whether or not the teams were good enough to deserve the money, because one was really good and one is not very good. It sounds like they're having a better season this year. But I also talked to a sports economist who said that whether or not a team is good doesn't usually have a direct impact on whether or not they're able to get that public financing, essentially.
Oh, interesting, because would it have made a difference if, and I know that, you know, the stadiums are tied together, but would it have made a difference if perhaps the Chiefs just went off and proposed some kind of bill to raise money for their stadium and kind of just left the Royals out of it? Because perhaps there is a little more goodwill with the citizens of Kansas City for their team.
Yeah, I think that definitely could have made a difference. I also think tying the two teams together in one vote, there was a lot of confusion locally about what people were voting for, because the Royals proposal was, it would have been, made a huge impact. You know, they would have been moving to a whole new part of town. People were worried about businesses getting, you know, moved out of their homes and rents increasing. Like, there was a lot of confusion and concern around that proposal. So even for the Royals, if they had more time to promote what their plan was, what the impacts would be on their own, they might have had more success. And I think they would have maybe been able to communicate a little bit clearer. And I definitely think for the Chiefs, same thing. I think they would have been able to both more clearly communicate to the public what exactly they wanted. One really interesting, I had a fun interview with a local Chiefs fan who told me, I think he had only missed two or three games in like a decade or something crazy. Wow. But he told me he was in favor of the proposal, but he was actually very underwhelmed by what the Chiefs were proposing, because a lot of their proposed renovations, you know, it was things like making the VIP boxes a little nicer and like increasing the amount of parking. But I don't necessarily think for fans, it would have totally changed the game day experience in a way that like really would have excited them. So it's really, it's anyone's guess whether they would have been successful if each of them had gone out on their own. But I do think with both proposals, it was very nuanced. And even with the Chiefs, which are really popular, people were kind of scratching their heads a little bit on their renovations as well.
Our thanks to Bloomberg News municipal finance reporter Amanda Albright for joining us. From Kansas City to soccer, the latest edition of The Deal with Alex Rodriguez and Jason Kelly is out, featuring U.S. soccer legend Brandi Chastain. They'll talk about everything from private equity to the growing appeal of women's sports. Let's take a listen to a portion of that conversation about her journey as a woman in sports.
I honestly believe that part of the equation that wasn't in our control was the mass general public and the business sector not ready for women.
Yeah.
Not ready for powerful women, not ready for women with big voices who have grand ideas. We didn't have the deep pockets. And before coming here today, I think that's the one thing that kept coming into my head was I had $0 that I could be an owner with.
That's U.S. soccer legend, Olympic gold medalist, world champion, and co-owner of Bay FC, Brandi Chastain, on the latest edition of The Deal with Alex Rodriguez and Jason Kelly. Catch the show on Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Television. Stream it on Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern, and find it wherever you get your podcasts. Up next, we turn to the Masters. You're listening to the Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds.
And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show, where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Barr, along with Scarlett Fu and Damian Sassauer. It's Masters weekend, and Bloomberg Business Week contributor and sports writer Alan Shipnuck has a new piece on the state of the sport and the rising tension between the PGA Tour and LIV. Everyone is rich. No one is happy. The pro golf drama is back. Yes, it is. Alan, welcome to the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
I'm delighted to be here.
Well, let's start with that. It's everybody's making money. This is hand over fist money. And then everybody is still whizzed off. It's like if I get home and I bring flowers and candy to Mrs. Barr, she'll then come to me and then say, well, you didn't get chocolate. Why didn't you get the chocolate? This is exactly what this is.
Yeah, on a macro scale, I mean, professional golfers have become the most overpaid athletes on the planet. Based on if you could do a ratio of the dollars they make to the fans they deliver, it's not even close. And it's a weird state of being that even as their pay has spiked tremendously, everyone's grouchy and everyone's complaining, and the whole sport has been sort of cleaved and. And it's gotten very messy. I mean, for those of us who write about it, it's fantastic. It is a gift from the content gods, but it's certainly the most contentious period in the history of professional golf right now. We're in the middle of it.
And now we have golfers who are affiliated with LIV Golf and, of course, pro golfers from the PGA Tour all meeting at the Masters for 4 days of fun. My question here is, what happened to the war between LIV Golf and PGA Tour? Because they were at each other's throats, then they surprised everyone with this announcement that they were actually going to team up and merge. And we know that all kinds of government regulators looked into this and said, hold on, we need to make sure that this is kosher. And now it's at a standstill. Nothing's happened.
Yeah, it was an active war zone. Now it turned into a cold war that's getting hot, is basically what's happened. The so-called framework agreement of June 2023 was an armistice, and both sides realized that they were hemorrhaging money through all these different lawsuits. I mean, the tour legal fees were into the tens of millions of dollars, as were LIV Golf's. And so that was basically an agreement to stop the lawsuits, mm-hmm. and everything they were going to figure out everything else. But the whole thing was oversold, and the messaging was way off from the beginning. And it was going to be a merger between the tour and LIV. That was never the case. It was basically the expectations were too high. All that was let's call off the lawsuits and see if we can find a way to work together. As it became clear, there was nothing binding in that deal. There was no penalties if either side backed out. Then that's when the real money started to move in from Wall Street, of course, but also Silicon Valley and Hollywood. And these guys started saying to the PGA Tour, you need money. We know you need money. We have money. You don't need the Saudis. You don't need the PIF. Like, let us invest in your business. And so that's what's happened. You know, the PGA Tour reshaped itself from this pass-through 501, you know, C6 into the new PGA Tour Enterprises, which is a for-profit business. They took $1.5 billion of investment from this Strategic Sports Group, which is a consortium of sports team owners and private equity guys in the U.S. and gals. And so that has ramped up all the intrigue even more, because now the PGA Tour is better capitalized than it's ever been in its history. They don't really need the Saudi money, but if they don't consummate this framework agreement, then they go back to LIV Golf and the PGA Tour, go back to these mortal enemies, and there's going to be bidding wars for the top players. And so it's in their best interest for the tour to consummate the deal, But now you have their other investors aren't so keen on it. The players, there's always been cold feet about it. There's government scrutiny. And so we're at a stalemate where they can't quite get this deal done, but they're not willing to let it blow up. And the whole sport is in limbo right now.
Alan, I know major networks like ESPN, CBS, et cetera, pay the PGA Tour something on the order of $700 million annually to televise and stream tournaments. Yet the PIF has sunk billions and billions of dollars into LIV and really don't have that much in terms of revenue or profitability to show for it, Scarlett. You know, Alan, take us through what is the PIF doing? I mean, are they hoping to extract some value from their investment, or is this just a trophy asset?
It's a little of both. You know, there's been this bidding war in among the Gulf states for big time European soccer teams. And that was a prestigious purchase. And now that everyone has one, it's not so special. But, you know, Saudi Arabia is the only country in the region that owns its own golf tour, right? And so there is a trophy aspect to it. Certainly MBS, you know, his the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, his Vision 2030 to reshape the entire economy and really culture of Saudi Arabia. Two of the pillars are sport and tourism, and golf can play a key role in both. And then you have the sports washing element where trying to launder the reputation of this oppressive regime. You know, golf has a very genteel reputation. It's a global sport played by the elite. So they're getting a lot through LIV Golf beyond a straight ROI. But of course, they do run a business and they do want to make money. And really the way that the PIF is hoping to extract a profit or at least get their money back is through the selling of the LIV Golf franchises. And that's a key thing to understand in this whole model is that the PIF owns 75% of each franchise. There's currently 13. They have plans to expand to two more. And their ambitious goal is to get $500 million for each franchise. If you do the math times 15, that would more than cover their costs. And it seems a little fantastical because right now these teams are not really earning any revenue, but sports has become an asset class. And if you look at how every team valuation has skyrocketed in recent years, and you know, you have European soccer clubs selling for $10 billion and on down the line, and institutional money has moved into sports across the board, across the world. Maybe the PIF is smarter than we know, and they are going to get this for these franchises because the LIV schedules become more and more international. 8 of the 14 events this year are going to be played outside the U.S., and they're going to new markets. They're going to Hong Kong. They're going to Korea. They're going to go to Japan next year. And they feel like in these markets, there's a bored billionaire, or maybe there's a multinational corporation that sees the value in investing in this sport and in this concept. And so that's how they will extract the value, is through the franchises. And they are hoping, of course, to grow their audience, to get better media deals, to make money through other kinds of corporate alliances. And but the real money is in the franchises, and that's the key to their whole plan.
I'm going to do like they do at the White House. I have a two-part question. First of all, the PIF, they have $860 billion. Now, how in the hell can anybody compete with that? That's one. The second question is, it's one thing if you're like a Tiger Woods and you're saying, you know what, I'm not going there. The PGA's been fine. I got a boatload of money already. I'm good. But let's say, for instance, the Damian Scarlett Network offered me a $10 million contract to come to your network. How can a younger player say no?
Well, part one is you can't compete with the PIF's money. And everyone kind of knew that. The tour for a brief moment tried. You know, the tour reshaped its schedule and its product, created these big money, limited field, exclusive events for their top players as a way to pay them live like money. But to foot the bill, they were squeezing all their corporate sponsors so hard, the sponsors started to flee, and the tour very quickly realized this is not sustainable. And that's when they decided to take the outside investment. So the tour tried for about 20 minutes to compete with the PIF's money, and it was obviously a non-starter. As for the good but not great, or the talented but not generationally wealthy golfer, yeah, a lot of them have gone to live because it's just a business decision. And what's made it complex is the source of the money, right? If LIV Golf was underwritten by European money or Australian money or American money, it would be a very different conversation. But you know, there's no real golf culture in Saudi Arabia. Their entrance into professional golf in what was through the European Tour in February of 2019. That was just months after Jamal Khashoggi was murdered, right. And obviously MBS has been implicated in that killing of a Washington Post reporter who was a resident of the United States. It's an undeniable fact that 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers were Saudi nationals, and so it's an emotional topic for a lot of sports fans, a lot of not just in the U.S. but elsewhere, that the Saudis are coming in and trying to reshape professional golf. And so the tour effectively made the LIV money radioactive. You know, Jay Monahan, the PGA Tour commissioner, famously went on TV and said, "When have you ever had to apologize for being a PGA Tour member?" The implication being, if you go to LIV, you do have to apologize. And that was a line of attack that was pretty effective. And various politicians took that up. Surviving members of 9/11 victims started protesting outside of LIV tournaments. So taking the money has come at a reputational cost for some of the golfers because of where the money is coming from. Then you have this parallel issue where LIV does not get world ranking points. And that is still, it may not be in the future, but right now that is the yardstick that the major championships use to fill out their fields. And major championships being the Masters, the PGA Championship, mm-hmm. the US Open and the British Open, those are the events that matter in golf. You know, there's the week in, week out filler, but it's the majors that define a career. It's what makes you a legend. It's what gets you into the Hall of Fame. And that's also where you get the big endorsement deals, is when you win the majors. And so to go to LIV, some of these players, the up and comers or the guys who were just hanging on, were essentially renouncing playing in the majors, yeah. because they were going to have to give that up. So that'd be like a baseball player saying, "Okay, I'll take a big contract from the Yankees, but we're barred from the World Series." And that doesn't sit right with certain fans. Like, wow, you really don't care about winning. You really don't care about what matters in this sport. So it hasn't been as simple as taking the money, because there's been these other issues that have tainted the money and made it more complex.
Really well said. Alan, fantastic story. And once again, it's the title is Everyone is Rich, No One is Happy. The Pro Golf Drama is Back. How could you resist reading that?
I can't. I mean, what a title. I mean, I love that header.
Read it for yourself. It's online at Bloomberg.com, and it will be in the upcoming edition of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. Up next, we bring in Baseball Hall of Famer Tom Glavine. You're listening to the Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show, where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Barr, along with my colleagues Scarlett Fu and Damian Sassauer. Guess who we have on the line? I'll give you a hint. He's an MLB Hall of Famer. He went in the class of 2014. Is it coming to you? 10-time All-Star pitcher. Ladies and gentlemen, Tom Glavine, welcome to the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Wow, man. This is so cool, man. I guess I'm going to ask the obvious question to start off. We're in the young start of the Major League Baseball season. Any early takeaways for you, sir?
Not a ton, you know. I mean, I think that for the most part, I think the teams that we thought were going to be good have gotten off to good starts. I guess it's a little bit concerning that we've had a number of really good pitchers get hurt already. So that's always a concern. But I think, you know, so far it's kind of been what everybody has expected, and we'll see how it plays out.
So about those pitching injuries, we know that the MLBPA head Tony Clark has been blaming it on the shortened pitch clock. Do you think there's a tie there? Is that a convenient explanation, or is there something to it?
I don't think so. Listen, I love Tony. Tony was a teammate of mine, and I think he's done a good job at the Players Association, but I got to disagree on this one a little bit. You know, I don't think the pitch clock has anything to do with it. You know, now I do think baseball made a mistake in changing the pitch clock for this year. You know, they made all sorts of changes last year, particularly the pitch count, the pitch clock. I think by and large, pitchers bought into it. They did a good job. The games were crisp. It was fun to watch. You know, and I think if Major League Baseball had a concern with the length of time of games creeping up a little bit as the season went on, then I think it should have been a conversation that said, hey, boys, or hey, fellas, we noticed this trend and we're going to keep watching it. If it continues, then we may have to adjust the pitch clock rather than just going ahead and doing it again after they got everybody to buy in last year. But having said that, I don't think it has anything to do with that. I think it has everything to do with what pitching has become across the board in baseball from high school to the big league. And it's all about velocity. All everybody cares about is how hard they throw, and everything they do is geared towards gaining more velocity. And I've been saying it for years. You cannot go out there as a pitcher and throw every pitch as hard as you can and not expect to get hurt. I mean, your body just can't handle that. Like you pick any endeavor, any physical activity, and if you do it at max effort for any length of time, you're going to get hurt, right? Like I always talk about Tiger Woods, right? When we all watched Tiger Woods come up as a young kid and we saw that swing, I think most people looked at it and said, he's swinging that hard. He's going to have back problems after a while, right? Well, lo and behold, he had back problems. So I think it's the same with pitching. It's, you know, you throw every single pitch as hard as you can. I just don't see how your shoulder, and mostly your elbow, which is what most guys seem to be having, I don't see how it's going to hold up.
Tom, hold on a second. Are you accusing Tiger Woods of overswinging, that he swings too? I want to get this straight for the record here. I mean, it is Masters Week, and I think the following week, you're going to be playing in the Celebrity Classic. I think Tony Romo is the reigning champ there. I mean, let's go back to 1995. Sean Kasten, president of the Atlanta Braves. I believe he built a putting green inside the clubhouse for you and your mates. Talk to us a little bit about that and how that helped your golf game and your putting game as you prepare for next week's match.
Okay, so first, I'm not accusing Tiger of swinging too hard. He swung hard, right? And I think over the years, that swing has slowed down a little bit. That's all. But, you know, as far as the putting green went, yeah, we did. You know, we were in Fulton County Stadium at the time, and we were moving into Turner Field that was being built for the Olympics. And, you know, Stan Kasten, the president of the club, said, hey, if, you know, we win a World Series, we'll put a putting green in. And, you know, lo and behold, we won a World Series and we had a putting green. So, you know, it worked out well. And I will say, you know, listen, we played a lot of golf, myself and Maddox and Smolty and
It was great, but it was I think it was a big part of what kept us sane during the baseball season. You know, I mean, baseball season's long. Everybody knows it, right? 162 games, and you're going at it for 9 months out of the year. It is a grind. So no matter what you do in life, you have to have an outlet. So for us, it was golf, and we enjoyed getting out and playing golf and getting out of the hotel and, you know, doing all those things. Inevitably, I would say a good portion of our conversation ended up being about baseball, but, you know, just to be outside and get away from everything for a couple of hours, I think that was a big part, like I said, of us kind of staying sane during a long and sometimes grueling baseball season.
One of the greatest stories in baseball, until it wasn't, was about Shohei Ohtani. And everybody was talking about Shohei. You couldn't get merchandise cheap anywhere. Ohtani merchandise, and then all of a sudden, here comes the gambling saga. Your thoughts on all of this and how it went down?
You know, I followed that casually, and I'm just going to say this. I hope that what Shohei is saying is true. I really do. I hope it's nothing more than that, and that he had a close friend who he trusted that maybe he shouldn't have, and he took advantage of him. I mean, that's as awful as that sounds, I hope that's the case, because that certainly would be in the best interest of baseball, right? We don't want to ever find out that Shohei had anything more going on than that. It certainly wouldn't be good for him, wouldn't be good for the game. I mean, anytime you have a superstar player like that, who quite frankly does put people in the seats, you know, you want it to be about that. You don't want it to be about other stuff. So you know, I think we've all been in situations where maybe we've had a friend take advantage of us, certainly not to that extent. But, you know, Shohei's in a little bit different stratosphere than the rest of us. So hopefully, like I say, just lesson learned. You gave somebody a little bit too much leeway, a little bit too much trust, and they betrayed you. I hope that's all that it is.
Whatever happened between Shohei and his best friend slash interpreter, I think the whole incident is a really good window into how sports betting is now colliding with every professional sport, and it's something that the athletes need to keep in mind. What do you think your career would be like if sports betting was a part of it? I'm not saying you would necessarily take part in it, but how would you think through some of the issues that keep coming up? Because this collision is kind of inevitable, given how much the players and the fans and the teams are bombarding everyone with advertisements on sports betting.
No, and it's a great question. And you know, to your point, I don't, you know, me personally, it probably wouldn't have affected me. I'm not a gambler. I mean, I'll go to a casino every once in a while if I happen to be somewhere and you know, play a little bit of blackjack. But I worked hard for my money and I like it, so I try not to give it away if I don't have to. So that's always been a deterrent for me. It's just not something that's interested me. To your point, it's getting harder and harder for players, right? Because we're in an era now where everything is everywhere. Sports betting is everywhere. I mean, you can't watch a sporting event on TV without being hit by commercials for DraftKings or, you know, some of these other things. So it's everywhere. And to think that these professional teams who have partnerships with a lot of these things, to think that these teams are going to do all this advertising and the players are going to be around it and hear it. And all the while it's, hey, players, this is good for everybody else, but it's not good for you. You can't help but think that eventually there's going to be somebody or somebodies that give in to the temptation or have the approach of, well, everybody else can do it, why can't we? And so, I mean, I think it's for me, when I saw this coming down the road, you know, I had a lot of these thoughts and I wondered, and I think we're starting to see some of it. I don't know what the sports organizations do really to try to get a better hold of it. But like I said, it's an odd dynamic when everything around so much of these sports now is that, but then the players themselves aren't allowed to participate. It's a really odd dynamic, but it's worth keeping an eye on.
You know, Scarlett, I still can't believe that Bobby Cox allowed Tom, Smolty, and Maddox to golf during off days during the season. I mean, that's just unbelievable. But, you know, Tom, talk to us a little bit about some of the hitters you faced in your career. I'm thinking Tony Gwynn. I think you played with Ken Griffey Sr., but Ken Griffey Jr. Talk to me about, you know, when you're in your head, you know, you're a competitor and you're thinking about that one guy who you just, you know, you really just hated to face. I mean, the names like Mike Redmond, Kip Pello, I mean, John Morris, Chelmsford Center, like who do you think of when you really just need to get the blood boiling?
There's a lot of names you just threw at me.
You like that, huh?
Yeah, I do like that. You know what? Look, it's everybody, like the crazy thing about baseball is like people ask that question. Well, you know, who did you hate to face or who did you fear? And listen, you didn't fear anybody. You had a healthy level of respect for everybody, but certain guys grabbed your attention more than others. You inevitably have somebody for a lot of guys that nobody would ever guess is the guy who owns you. In my case, it was Mike Redmond. You know, I said it all the time. If I was pitching, he was sending a limo to get me to the ballpark. I mean, that's just the way that it was, you know, and I think we all had one of those guys. You know, yeah. I think for Smoltz, I look back, I think it was John Cantalosi who used to wear him out. So, but then there are certain guys, listen, you name a lot of those guys, right? Barry Bonds, Tony Gwynn, Albert Pujols, guys like that that, you know, for the most part, when you get ready for a start against somebody and you throw your bullpens and you practice, you know, you kind of go through your repertoire, you practice, you do your pitches, whatever. But then every once in a while, when you're facing a Tony Gwynn or a Barry Bonds or an Albert Pujols, knowing you're facing those guys will creep into your practice. You know, like I might, you know, if at certain times during the year I wasn't throwing my curveball or my slider as much, but I knew I was going to face Barry or Tony in a start, then I would probably practice that pitch a little bit more than I might other times. Mm. If I knew I was facing Pujols, said, hey, I know I have to be able to pitch the inside part of the plate against him to keep him honest, I might practice that a little bit more in my side session. So those guys grab your attention, no question about it, and you plan for them. But those are the special guys, right? Most of the time it's just you know who you're facing, you know what you're trying to do, you know what you're trying to fix or work on in terms of your game, and you kind of leave it there. But those elite players, they'll creep into your preparation and you'll do some things specifically to get ready to prepare for those guys.
See, this is why I get excited. MLB Hall of Famer, 10-time All-Star pitcher, 2-time National League Cy Young Award winner, a.k.a. Super Dude, Tom Glavine. Thank you so much, sir, for joining us on the Bloomberg Business of Sports. Man, it was an honor. Really do appreciate it.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports. We are here each and every week at the same time. For my colleagues, Scarlett Fu and Damian Sassauer, I'm Michael Barr. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again next week for the latest on the stories moving big money in the world of sports. You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.